working to legalize cannabis in this industry, in the state, you know, we really have, you know, three main goals. Ending criminal penalties, keeping patients protected and safe access for patients, and helping small Oregon farmers and mom and pops. As far as reducing criminal penalties goes, the state and the citizens, we've done a great job. You know, in 2011, not that long ago, the state of Oregon was arresting and citing more than 1,200 people a month for cannabis offenses. Now, since legalization, that number is down to 20. So that's something we can all be proud of. Not only good for Oregon, but that's something that spreads across the state and actually across the world. Now, as far as protecting patients and small farmers, we got more work to do. And me, myself, other activists, we're not going to stop fighting until patients are all protected, and that mom and pops here in Oregon, who have been the foundation of the medical program, which has taken care of patients, were the backbone for legalization, and has really saved the state money by providing medical cannabis to patients, that it's cut down on prescription drug costs, cut down on the opiate crisis. They're really the foundation. So we got three great panelists who have all been fighting in various realms to help us. We do have a schedule change if you look in your program. Lee Berger is moved to the distribution panel. It's a great honor to introduce.
He's been redistributed.
Yeah, redistributed to the distribution panel. First up, I'd like to introduce Anthony Taylor. I'll introduce everybody on the panel, but Anthony Taylor, Director of Compassion in Oregon, really the leading lobbyist in the state, working to help patients, small farmers all across the state. He was instrumental, really leading the effort to adding post-traumatic stress as a qualifying condition at the legislature. So a round of applause for that, for sure. You know, as far as what the legislature's working and what's working on medical, he's the man that we all really turn to. Sitting next to him, replacing Lee, is Sandy Diesel. Sandy's the director of Right to Grow, another patient advocate organization. I think it's safe to say it's taking the really the fight really in Southern Oregon, Jackson County, and helping farmers and patients there. And then lastly is Brian Michaels. Brian's a longtime lawyer. I asked him how long he's been practicing law. Of course, he said too long, but more than 20 years protecting patients and people in our industry.
Currently, OLCC will not license a residential grow. So I know a lot of folks who grow medically grow out of the residence. So if we go into OLCC, I can see that being a problem.
Anybody?
Is there any talk going on about that?
Yeah, I believe that the OLCC is not going to license a residence, but if you can have a structure on your property and you're not in a purely residential zoned area, that structure that's not inside your residence can be licensed by the OLCC. But the OLCC does not want to send inspectors into someone's home.
It's a licensed premises. So if you have an existing, say me, I live on my farm, I could have the licensed premises be where the garden area is, and I could still live in my home with my children.
Not if you're in a residence. If you're in a suburban area and you're in a residence,
in a city
they're
limits?
Not going to, yes, it, yeah. Within the city limits. Right now there's a lot of medical growers within the city limits.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately.
I think what they're trying to express to you in this answer is, OLCC's position, which, by the way, changed. Originally, they didn't exclude residential. Is, and she used the rural grow to make the point, if you have a rural grow, you're not allowed to have any part of that grow operation from seed to sale, as it was, occur in your home. Because OLCC feels that they're not allowed to go into your home. And that's, I think, the point that they were trying to make. They have this notion that you can't waive your right against them entering your home by virtue of your license. I don't know why they want to take that position, but that's their rationale behind taking that position. They can't use the urine against you in a criminal court unless you do the DRE. So if you can remember this simple mnemonic, which is always blow, always pee, never do a DRE. And there is no consequence for refusing to do a DRE. They don't tell you this. they just start doing it. And when they start taking your pulse, when they start taking your blood pressure and asking you to do funny little things after you've blown into the breathalyzer, that's your DRE. If you can remember to stop them, you don't lose your license, you don't have any consequences whatsoever for refusing to do a DRE. That's the only way you will not be arrested. And the thing is, the reason that you don't have to be under the influence is, in Oregon, if you don't have a DUI, if you first DUI, you can do a diversion. Anybody will take a diversion over trying to win a criminal case. Costs money, uncertainty. So in order to go into diversion, even though you have a great case, I've talked with clients, you look at the video, they're perfectly sober and straight. I had one with a cop when he was demonstrating how to do the heel and toe, slipped and almost fell. But my guy did better than he did. Honest. But they know that everybody's going to take a diversion. In order to get into a diversion, you have to plead guilty. Click. Another notch to their statistics. This guy, a woman, pled guilty to DUI. See, we got all these DUIs on the road. Marijuana DUIs. Marijuana is evil. It's making us dangerous. This is a little practical knowledge that you can have, because any one of you is vulnerable to getting a DUI under marijuana because they know you're a medical marijuana cardholder. Whether you're in the dispensary, whether you're producing, or whether you're a patient. So I give you that advice out of all contexts of this here today, so that maybe you'll walk away and next time one of you is involved in this horrible thing, and I see many of these, you'll remember always blow, always pee, never do a DRE. If you can remember that, you won't get arrested and you'll walk home. There's also issues on forfeiture, but I think my time is up. If you have questions about dogs who smell currency and they make like it's marijuana, I'll talk to you about that. But I think my time is up for now. Hopefully I give you something to think about when you get stopped on the road.
What happened in 2015 is they limited plants. They enacted a very expensive growth site registration fee per patient rather than per address, and they started reporting. And those three things were responsible from taking from January 2015 to October of 2016, jacking those numbers, doubling them. They went from 7,000 and change to right now to 17,000 and change. And it's simply because people don't want to report, so they kicked their patients aside and said, we don't want to report, so you'll have to find another grower. And since a lot of people were in I don't want to report mode, they didn't do it. Or the growth site registration fee, which is $200 a patient now, has to be paid by the grower, not the patient. So that, you know, muddled things up too. I expect to see this number continue to grow until we have a voluntary registry list of the growers that are willing to take on more patients. But even that's complicated because some of those people that are growing their 48 plants and they've got 8 patients, when they start, they're allowed to give their cannabis away and have more patients than the requisite 8 to get you to 48 plants. But that starts, if anybody's trying to, you know, eke out some kind of compensation for the compassionate care they're given, that eats into the amount of cannabis that's available for the market. And so that's not happening particularly. And I do expect this trend to continue until we have that voluntary list that patients can find their growers. Because there's lots of people out there right now. Anthony's wife, Sarah, is hooking up patients with growers, but it's getting tougher and tougher, and I don't see that changing really. Especially if the legislature gets their way and limits the number of medical grows to a non-designated garden to 6 per household.
You know, what about the potential of medical growers getting access into the OLCC market, particularly those that have been, you know, zoned out by their cities or counties? Any hope for that in the legislature?
There's some hope that's beginning to come up over the horizon. The argument has been for a long time that the medical marijuana patients can't have access to the adult use market because they haven't securitied up. They haven't come into compliance with OLCC licensures. There's one bill, 2198, right now, that brings everybody into metric seed-to-sale tracking, but the trade-off for that, and I, just a quick aside, I don't think metric is going to be that problematic for people growing 36 or 48 plants on the grower side. On the dispensary side, I don't think it's going to be a problem either because they're used to reporting already. Where are we again?
Hope for 2198.
Oh, yeah, 2198. So what 2198 does is the trade-off bringing everybody into metric is to allow medical marijuana growers to bring 25 pounds a year into the adult use system through the wholesalers and the processors. So that will, not everybody's going to be in there bothering the retail shop owners with, intake and processing. They'll go through the wholesalers. The wholesalers can, leak it out into the system as they do, and then the processors can bring in the leaf and stuff like that for them to process. So if this passes, it means that the 9,000 growers that will be captured in this metric tracking system, because the people growing 12 plants or less are exempt from it under this bill, it'll basically bring about 225,000 pounds into the adult use market that would be going into the black market. So the wholesalers and actually the retailers are really starting to like this because they miss their medical marijuana growers. They miss the relationships they had, and they miss the products and the handcrafted, if you will, products that these growers are bringing in because they have time to take care of two plants that are one specific strain for a patient they're dealing with, and then they have excess. So I think it's a good thing. I think if we all call our marijuana regulation committee and say, support 2198, I think we've got a good chance of getting most of this bill through.